From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan is in the midst of the worst outbreak of deadly eastern equine encephalitis in a decade. 7 confirmed cases and 3 deaths.
He was perfectly healthy, happy human being. And within a matter of 9 days, he went from perfectly healthy to brain dead.
What graduating students get in Michigan's promise zones could depend on where they live.
But many of these programs actually direct most of their financial resources to students that are not economically disadvantaged.
And a London police officer on years of visiting Detroit watching its police department at work.
So I'm out with the cops, and I've never seen anything quite like it. Just the amount of poverty, the amount of crime. Obviously, the first thing you notice, especially 15 years ago, is the blight. It seemed like the most extreme place to police.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is in the middle of its worst outbreak of eastern equine encephalitis, Triple E, in more than a decade. That declaration from Michigan's chief medical executive, Dr. Jonae Khaldun, she announced there have been 7 confirmed human cases of Triple E and 3 deaths, mainly in southwest Michigan. One of the deaths, 64-year-old Greg McChesney of Kalamazoo County. His brother Mark told Wood TV that Greg's death in August was shockingly sudden.
He was perfectly healthy, happy human being. And within a matter of 9 days, he went from perfectly healthy to brain dead. I mean, right off the bat, we were like, how could this happen? What did happen? Mm-hmm. And we just didn't know. And the doctors were just doing everything they could to try to say it was this or that, and they just couldn't figure it out.
The other 2 deaths occurred in Van Buren and Cass counties. Jim Rutherford is the Kalamazoo County Health Officer. Jim, we're being told that eastern equine encephalitis is one of the most dangerous viruses on the planet. Why is that?
Well, it's just it's transmitted through mosquitoes, which are readily prevalent all across the world. In our neck of the woods in southwest Michigan, we've got 7 confirmed cases within the state, 3 of which within Kalamazoo County. So it's very concerning for us. The real concern with the virus is that if you contract it and it turns into eastern equine encephalitis, the fatality rate is quite high, which it's about 33%. And as concerning, those that do survive oftentimes have lingering neurological conditions that can last for the rest of their lives.
And how are these mosquitoes getting infected, the ones that are carrying it? What's the source?
They get it from the reservoir. The source that they're getting it from is from birds.
Okay.
And birds don't typically die from eastern equine encephalitis. So historically, we've been able to use birds as sentinel. So when we get dead birds for West Niles, we know that we're going to have a pretty significant summer, or late summer, early fall. For West Niles, it's just not the case with this type of eastern equine encephalitis. So we don't really have that sentinel factor. And unfortunately, we start seeing it in human beings first.
And according to the Centers for Disease Control, Michigan reported 7 cases between 2009 and 2018. And as you say, here we have 7 so far this year in southwest Michigan.
Which is concerning, right?
Yeah.
And to go a decade without a lot of activity, and all of a sudden we get hit with a significant amount of human cases, it certainly is concerning.
What's the best guess as to why this is happening?
Well, I think that there's a lot of variables that are taken into consideration. A lot of it is the weather, the amount of surface water. Obviously, mosquitoes breed and they do a lot of their activity on water. So when that's prevalent, you're going to get higher numbers. Beyond that, I really can't tell you. I'm not an entomologist.
Sure, sure. Now, the state has advised people consider postponing or canceling outdoor activities until the first hard frost. What are you telling people in Kalamazoo County?
Well, I kind of take a more of a realistic approach because we know that it's difficult to expect people to. We can't quarantine people from doing what they do. This is obviously the prettiest time of the year in Michigan. People are going to hike. People are going to take advantage of going to sporting events. Really what I'm pushing and what I'm strongly recommending is this is a very preventable disease. Mosquito repellent is readily available at just about any store that you go into, and it's very effective. So We have a prevention tool that's easily accessible. You know, we've worked with superintendents and schools within our respective community, just reminding them of the fact that it's preventable. If they want to be able to try it or they have the ability to reschedule, this type of mosquito is most active from dawn to dusk. So, you know, if that's a possibility, if it's not, then certainly mosquito repellent is very effective.
What about steps that you'd like homeowners or businesses to take to just kind of reduce the prevalence of mosquitoes?
Well, homeowners in particular, if you've got standing water on your property, those are breeding grounds for mosquitoes. If you've got a playground equipment on a playground, you know, if there's water that can be drained, then drain it. We've had schools actually, part of what their maintenance staff does now is kind of purvey the property to see if there's any standing water that needs to be removed. That's something that's easily done as well.
One of the things that struck us as we heard Mark McChesney just talking about his brother Greg's death is he's saying, you know, we didn't know. And doctors were trying to figure what it was, and they couldn't figure it out. So I guess symptoms, warning signs, what should people be aware of?
Well, symptoms are similar to flu-like symptoms in terms of respiratory illness. Headache, fatigue, dizziness are all signs of that. But oftentimes, and particularly as we approach, you know, seasonal influenza, some of those symptoms are going to be prevalent as a result of other types of infections. So, you know, we work with our local physicians to try to educate them, to try to use that as a potential consideration for diagnostic work when they're pulling samples for laboratory analysis. You know, have you taken that bad encephalitis into consideration? So I think locally we've done a good job, and we've been messaging this for several months now because we started having cases. I think early onset was in July of this year. So, you know, we've been fairly active, and we continue to educate our community, and hopefully we've done a good job of that.
Jim Rutherford, Kalamazoo County Health Officer. Thanks so much, Jim.
Yeah, have a great day.
As the UAW strike against General Motors continues into its third day, both sides are still at the bargaining table. So let's see if there's been any progress as we check in again with Mike Martinez, who's covering the strike for the Automotive News. So, Mike, any progress to report?
Well, there's at least one side saying there's been a little progress made, but that's hard to tell whether that's just gamesmanship or if there's really anything happening. It still seems like the two sides are very far apart on a number of issues, including wages, the use of temporary workers, healthcare, a lot of things we've been talking about. So not a whole lot of updates on that front.
This has to be for a reporter. It's tough to cover something that's happening behind closed doors and isn't supposed to be talked about a lot.
Exactly. It's tough. I mean, we're working our sources just like everybody is. We've had some information come out about GM's first proposed offer in regards to how much they wanted workers to pay for their health care. We've had a few details about wages and lump sum bonuses here and there, but it's kind of tough. Just like you said, they're all talking. They don't want us to hear what they're saying.
Now, one of the things that seems to have jumped out at everyone is the fact that General Motors has stopped paying for health care coverage for striking workers. But didn't the union send out a letter telling strikers GM will continue health care benefits through the end of the month as provided in the contract?
There was a little bit of confusion there. And yes, I'd send out that letter on Monday. Terry Dittus, the UAW GM VP, said that it should continue through the end of the month, but then GM pulled the plug immediately, and Terry sent a second letter Tuesday saying that as of Tuesday, that healthcare coverage would end. Now, as far as I've been told, that's a normal part of a strike. When you vote yes, you essentially give up that right to have those benefits if you're refusing to work for the company. But it's also important to note that the union will continue to have some healthcare coverage through COBRA, and that's going to be paid for out of the union strike fund.
And it is interesting to see General Motors is already being hit by some national politicians for doing this. Is this a bargaining tactic that could backlash?
you never know what's going to happen. It's clearly a tactic on GM's part, because all of a sudden for the union, this becomes a lot more expensive. You're going to be dipping into that strike fund a lot more than you were just to pay out that $250 a week in strike pay if they get to an eighth day. Now, the strike fund has about $750 million in it, so they can go for a while, but it still hurts. But like you said, at the same time, GM's getting some blowback. The optics aren't great there.
And just to remind everyone, these workers are getting strike pay, $250 a week, but they're not going to get it for a while, so people are going to have to make do.
Exactly. It starts on day eight, and we're only into day three, as crazy as that seems.
The Lansing State Journal is quoting a UAW Local 724 official saying suppliers to Lansing's GM plants have already started laying off employees. Are you hearing any reports of how this strike could be impacting the supply side?
Well, the supply side, last I heard, was still sort of holding steady. But you can see that as it goes on, you could start to see some layoffs there. The last time we had checked, GM had told its suppliers to continue building parts. But beyond that, we're seeing some ripple effects in Canada. Unifor, the Canadian union, just announced this afternoon that GM was going to temporarily lay off 1,200 workers in Ontario at Oshawa, essentially because they're not building stuff in the U.S., and that affects what happens and what they build in Canada.
So the ripple effect continuing, and you're trying to work those sources and find out what is happening behind those closed doors.
Definitely. We'll see. Again, nobody really knows how long this is going to last. Ford put out a note saying they've reached agreements on 11 out of 20 subcommittees, which indicates Ford's ready to go whenever GM can get a deal. So you wonder if that is a sign that GM's close too.
Mike Martinez, Automotive News. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Kalamazoo Promise was announced to much fanfare back in 2005. Now there are 21 various Promise programs around the state, each with its own approach and funding.
These programs vary from each other in ways large and small, and I think it's safe to say that no two of them are alike.
We'll check in to see what's working and what's not. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Leaping from branch to branch, burying nuts and acorns, teasing a backyard dog by staying just out of reach. Let's face it, squirrels are so common in Michigan, it's easy for us to take their presence for granted. But just as Holden Caulfield worried about where the ducks go in winter, we got to wondering, where do squirrels go during winter? Do they cluster up in some hibernation hole or perhaps join Michigan's snowbirds and head towards warmer locales? It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And with us today, State Archivist Mark Harvey. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you.
The observation of squirrels, I guess, have been going on since there were humans here in this region. But do we know when the first written account was?
Well, I tried to go as far back as I could on this one. That usually leads me to looking at the Jesuit relations, and they actually talk about squirrels and the squirrel nation or the squirrel tribe in 1651 in New France. Now, that's a little further north than we currently are, but it's in the general region of Lower Ontario. Lewis and Clark also wrote about them in 1803, swimming the Ohio River, headed south, and then we have lots of written references after that in Michigan proper.
In fact, people observed some pretty intense and huge squirrel migrations. Tell us about those.
Well, I don't know where to start, Cynthia.
Unusual
topic.
It is. And I mean, even the idea of, as you say, Lewis and Clark observing squirrels swimming across the river in great amounts. And so where were these chatterboxes migrating from, where to where?
There's all sorts of accounts of them. It starts with some 19th century accounts in Michigan where people relied on them as a source of food and then clothing because there were so many of them. They literally had to beat them back with clubs. There's actually a written account that farmers were forced to harvest squirrels in order to protect their crops and barns, up to killing up to 20,000 squirrels within a week.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty heavy. So for food and clothing, a very rich source for these early settlers.
Yep.
And then what about these migrations and going across the river? And even after the Mackinac Bridge opened, did I understand that the squirrels would be walking across the bridge?
Yeah. So starting in 1851, the residents of Holland, Michigan dubbed it the year of the squirrel, quote unquote, because the squirrels were just devastating their crops and gardens in biblical proportion. And then there's accounts in 1866 in the Saginaw Valley, 1922 in decades after up at the Straits, and then 1986 on the Garden Peninsula in the UP, 2004 in Grand Haven. So you mentioned the bridge. There was a gentleman up there, a Youper named Don Densmore, that started noticing them in 1922 trying to swim north across the Straits, which is a perilous swim under the best of circumstances.
So not an entirely successful swim by these squirrels, I must imagine.
No, the swim range is around, for a squirrel, is around 2 miles. Mm. And the birds would harass him. And so maybe some made it, but most of them just drowned and washed back up on shore. And then they got wise because in 1957, the year the bridge opened, they saw that span as a way to cross the water without swimming. And it got to be such a problem that bridge workers had to, quote-unquote, remove them, which probably usually meant shooting them off the bridge, to keep them from being a traffic hazard. So it's hard enough for a motorist to cross that bridge without dodging squirrels. And I don't know, you know, it's been a while since I've been on the Labor Day bridge walk, so maybe they're inconspicuously trying to work their way into that event.
Do we know when the last big squirrel migration was in Michigan?
The last recorded one that was reported was the one in 2004 in Grand Haven, Michigan. And there was lots of confusion initially over that because people found dozens of dead squirrels floating in the Grand River and washing up on the Lake Michigan beaches. And officials thought there was a disease issue or maybe a mass poisoning, but all the lab reports came back negative and it was determined they had just drowned.
Were they trying to get away from winter? Were they trying to come back here when the weather was warm? What do we think was going on with these big migrations?
So I talked to the Michigan DNR biologist, Adam Bump, and pretty much put the question to him. And he said the word migration really needs air quotes around it, because that usually implies movement due to weather over long distances. And what, as near as they can tell, the phenomenon is pretty much the province of the gray squirrel. And the best explanation is that during food abundance, the squirrel populations increase to a point that depletes all their resources and or triggers a behavior to get them to move on to greener pastures.
Okay. And the point that you make about gray squirrels leads me to wonder just how many types of squirrels make their home in Michigan. And the reason I'll ask this is I grew up in Oakland County in Ferndale, southern Oakland County, and all we ever had were those little, like, reddish-orange squirrels. And my first big job out of college, 1976, I was over in Grosse Pointe, and I went, look at these black squirrels. We never had them in Ferndale, but they've moved because now if you drive through Ferndale, they are there. So how many kinds of squirrels do we have?
It's a bit of a trick question because squirrels covers everything from a woodchuck to chipmunks to other types of ground squirrels to flying squirrels. Which are flying squirrels or a type of tree squirrel. So I think most people commonly, when they speak of a squirrel, they're thinking of a tree squirrel. And yes, in Michigan, there's three main ones. The red squirrel, which you mentioned, which are a little bit smaller. Some people call them boomers because they're so loud.
Okay.
The fox squirrel and the gray squirrel.
So is the black squirrel that I saw in Grosse Pointe when I first started working, is that actually the gray squirrel?
Yeah, that is a black phase gray squirrel. And I have to tell you, whenever I correct somebody on that, no one appreciates the difference of the... And I grew up in East Lansing, and there was a very distinct pocket of them in East Lansing. And if you went a few miles to the west in Lansing, you would not see them. So I think they're just pocketed around the state with that black color factor.
There we go. So back to the original question, where do Michigan squirrels go during the winter?
Well, actually, nowhere. They don't hibernate. They just hang out eating their cache of food, trying to stay warm and not driving each other nuts.
There you go, or us as well.
Yeah.
Well, that is it. All you ever wanted to know about squirrels going nuts here in Michigan. Mark Harvey, State Archivist with the Michigan History Center. Thank you so much for biting into this nut of squirrel migration.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The 2019 high school graduation was a special one for students in Kalamazoo. Those graduating seniors were in kindergarten for the start of the Kalamazoo Promise. That's the program that gives them a tuition-free path to a post-secondary education. So these kids have had the Kalamazoo Promise from their very start. It's a good time to review these Promise programs and how they're faring in Michigan. To help us with that, I spoke to Michelle Miller Adams this past spring. She's a political science professor at Grand Valley State University and a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Michelle, since it all began in 2005 in Michigan with Kalamazoo, there are 21 unique Promise programs around the state. Can you give us some examples of the variety of programs out there for students in Michigan?
That is a great question, because these programs vary from each other in ways large and small, and I think it's safe to say that no two of them are alike. We have programs that will, like the Kalamazoo Promise, allow students to go to any public and some private institutions in Michigan, have their tuition covered all or in part. We also have programs that allow students to attend just a local community college, and then we have everything in between. The reason is that these programs come out of their local community, and they're set up really to respond to local needs, and they build on the community's local assets. So that's why they look a little bit different in different places.
Now, the Kalamazoo Promise is funded by anonymous donors, and boy, that secret has been buttoned down all of these years. They've
sure
done a good
has.
Job.
Yep.
But not all communities are so lucky. Where do some of these other programs get the money to send kids on to post-secondary education?
Once again, there's a pretty wide variety in terms of funding. We have a population of programs in Michigan, about 15 of them, that are Michigan Promise Zones that were authorized by our legislature. And the funding for those particular programs is a mixture of private and public money. But the rest of the programs are really funded by private philanthropy, private business. I don't think any other program is funded anonymously, but the sources of funding are similar in different communities.
So when we hear of Promise Zones, there's some state money involved in that.
Yes, that was an innovative financing structure that was pioneered under the Granholm administration and then was expanded under the Snyder administration, where communities raise money locally, philanthropic money, business money, individual money, and then after a couple of years, they start to receive a portion of the increase in the state education tax. This is the kind of funding structure that's sometimes used for downtown development districts. It's called a tax increment financing structure. So there's kind of a kickback of state money into these local Promise programs mm-hmm. that supplements the philanthropic and corporate money that has been raised.
Michelle, there's another fundraising distinction that we'd love to have you explain for us, the difference between a first dollar program and a last dollar program.
Sure, and that's a really important difference. So a first dollar program, of which there are almost none, Kalamazoo Promise is one of them, and we do have one other example in Michigan, is a scholarship that students get first. They get it before their other sources of financial aid, and then if they qualify for other financial aid resources, like the largest one, of course, is Pell Grants, those will get added on top of the Promise Grant. Most programs are structured on what's called a last dollar basis, where students use their need-based aid first, and then if there's a gap between what their Pell Grants will cover and the cost of tuition and fees, the Promise program will close that gap.
Okay.
And that's a much more economical way to structure a Promise program, which is why most of them are structured that way.
And as you look at these different models across the state, these various funding models, do they affect which students can take advantage of the program and, you know, which ones tend to work better than others?
They do. They have really important what we could call distributional impacts, and I don't think that anybody designs a Promise program to not help the neediest of students, but many of these last dollar programs have the unintended consequence of bringing most of their resources to students that are not poor. And the reason for that is that many of these programs only provide a path to a two-year institution and serve many low-income students who qualify for Pell Grants. And in Michigan, a maximum Pell Grant will more than cover your community college tuition. What that means is in a Promise community that has a last dollar community college only Promise, low-income students are not getting any new money. The new money is going to students just above the Pell Grant cutoff. And there are a couple of things I want to say about that. One is that many students who are above the Pell cutoff still have a hard time affording college. They don't have access to Pell Grants, and yet college costs have risen so much that this is a population that really needs support, so that's a good thing. And there are some other benefits that come along with having a very simple, clear promise program. So, for example, if you can say to students in a school district like Detroit, for example, your tuition and fees will be covered at any one of our local community colleges, over the years, you're going to get many more of those students filling out their FAFSA and actually tapping those Pell Grants that they are qualified for. So there are still benefits for low-income students, but many of these programs actually direct most of their financial resources to students that are not economically disadvantaged. And I think that's important to understand, and I think it's largely an unintended consequence of this first dollar, last dollar distinction.
Let's talk about student achievement. Some programs like Kalamazoo seem to have certain disparities as far as how well students of color and low-income students are succeeding in whatever they do in their post-secondary education compared to their white and higher-income peers. Why is there that gap, and is that common among other Promise programs?
Yeah, that's common everywhere among Promise programs. It's common in school districts all around the country, and it really has to do with poverty. And as you know, and your listeners know, there's a strong overlap between being a person of color and being a child in poverty. And so when you see racial disparities show up, they're usually a function of socioeconomic disparities. And the achievement gap is not something that just magically shows up around high school graduation or college-going race. It goes all the way back. It goes back to who has had the opportunity to have a high-quality early childhood experience when they're 3 and 4 years old, who enters kindergarten ready to learn, who gets suspended at higher rates. It's African-American boys. That's the answer. Mm. And so those achievement gaps run throughout the entire pre-K through 12 system, and it's not surprising at all that they continue to show up around high school graduation, college going, college progression, and college degree completion.
Can schools and Promise organizations take steps to reduce these achievement gaps? Are they doing that?
Yes. They one of the most important things they do is that when these disparities show up, they kind of shine a spotlight back onto that K through 12 experience to say why. Why are African American males coming through this school district so much less likely to go to college? Or if they go to college, why are they so much less likely to receive a degree? And so it really forces communities to kind of look back and examine what's going on, not just in their school districts, but in their communities, where maybe you have high poverty neighborhoods or areas of concentrated poverty or schools that have very high levels of concentrated poverty or generational poverty. And so many of these Promise programs, and this is certainly true in Kalamazoo, they go hand in hand with efforts to address those underlying causes of generational poverty. That's not coming directly from the school district or directly from the Promise program, but these programs are catalysts for attention to things that happen outside of school. And as we all know, what happens outside of school is a really important predictor of what's going to happen in school.
Michelle, looking ahead 12 years down the road, when today's kindergartners will be graduating high school, what do you think needs to happen to ensure that the existing Promise programs are sustainable and effective and that new ones emerge?
I think in our state in particular, we have a crisis of school funding. We are underfunding our K through 12 institutions. We're actually underfunding our higher ed institutions as well. So schools are strapped for resources. Even schools that have experienced enrollment growth, like the Kalamazoo Public Schools, there aren't enough guidance counselors, there aren't enough school psychologists, there aren't enough support staff for kids with special needs. There is a lot of work that can be done about making school districts healthier and less resource-strapped that I think would be very helpful. I also think there's a lot of work that can be done in communities to really rally around students that face economic disadvantages and really bring them the supports that they need all the way from pre-K on up into tutoring, mentoring programs designed around college going and college success. The good news is that because of its focus on place, on relatively small places, a city, a school district, a county, these promise programs can act as catalysts to bring those supports into existence. And we've seen that in Kalamazoo, so I really think that some of these disparities that we're seeing now as kind of our first generation of promise students graduate will be reduced in coming years.
Michelle Miller Adams, Grand Valley State University. It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
After the break, in his new book, American Ruin, a London police officer writes about his years visiting Detroit, watching its police at work.
So I called up the American Embassy in London and said, hey, I want to join the NYPD. And there's a bit of silence. I said, are you American? I said, no. And they said, well, no. And they hang up.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. An outsider's viewpoint can be a really good reality check, a way to see things with fresh eyes and see what's working and what doesn't. The book American Ruin by Michael Matthews presents that outsider's view of Detroit and its police department. Michael Matthews was a police officer in London for more than 20 years, and for 15 of those years, he's been observing and getting to know Detroit officers on and off the job. We talked earlier this year and began by exploring his longtime fascination with American policing since he was a kid.
The cop shows, the movies, it's all about American police. And I became obsessed with American policing as a young child, and I believe that's what policing is about, you know. It was so exciting to a kid. These car chases, the guns, the perps, all this sort of stuff to a, you know, a kid in the suburbs in London. It was very exciting. And my father had been a police officer in London. As I grew up, I started thinking more and more about having a police career. But because of my exposure to what I've seen on TV, in my mind, it was an American police career. So I called up the American Embassy in London and said, hey, I want to join the NYPD. And there's a bit of a silence. I said, are you American? And I said, no. And they said, well, no. And they hang up.
Good luck with that.
Exactly. But, you know, I never forgot those sort of dreams and hopes of becoming an American cop. And then some years, I joined the London police as a bobby. And some years into that career, I was attacked at work when I was on duty and I was injured. I got a small payout from court and I wanted to use the money to come to America. One of the movies I was obsessed with was Jaws, Chief Brody. I thought, I want to go to Martha's Vineyard where they filmed Jaws. So I went there, I met a cop on the island, we swapped patches, and we're still friends to this day. And he said, why don't you come for a ride along? So I did. And that started this journey around America in the back of police cars. And I took 3 months off work, did a massive tour of the United States, started in Alaska, ended up in Maine, went to the Deep South, Texas, everywhere, Midwest, Indian reservations. And one of those stops was Detroit.
And when was that? I want to get some context.
This was 2004.
Okay, so long before the bankruptcy, long before. Yeah. So yeah, we're talking.
It was a different
years.
Place then, obviously. So 15 years ago, and I came to Detroit, and despite having been to Baltimore and Chicago and Compton and LA, Detroit was different. There's an edge here, and I describe it as extreme policing. Mm. In fact, the first cop I went out with was Steve Dolan, who recently retired as assistant chief, but he was an inspector back then, and he took me around, and I've never seen anything quite like it. Just the amount of poverty. The amount of crime. Obviously, the first thing you notice, especially 15 years ago, is the blight. Downtown was boarded up, it was dirty, there was nothing there. And then the neighborhoods were just an absolute mess. I mean, it's horrific to see. But as a cop, it was fascinating because, as I say, it seemed like the most extreme place to police.
So through the years, you came back and forth. Detroit kept drawing you back. You say you've come to love Detroit. Give us just an idea of some of the things you've seen while you've been going around with Detroit cops.
You know, I've been to homicide scenes, I've got to know gang members, the usual policing runs, you know, car chases, assaults, barricaded men in houses, dealing with drug addicts, all the usual stuff. But it's getting to know the gang members is one of the things that really interests me. So the cops would take me out and I'd just get speaking to people.
So you were getting to know cops and people.
And the regular people. And that's actually, I say in the book how much I love Detroit. And what I love about Detroit, and I mean this genuinely, it's not that downtown's great. It's not that, you know, they've got nice restaurants there now. What I've always loved about Detroit is the people, the cops, but also the people I speak to, because they are generally interested in me and why I'm there, and they want to talk to me. And that's not the case everywhere, but in Detroit it is.
Now, I have to jump right into something that you address in the very first few paragraphs of your book. Why did you call it American Ruin? I mean, you must have expected you were going to take some heat for that title.
Definitely. Me and the publisher discussed this. We're trying to think of a title. And I said, you know, I came up with American Ruin. I said, there's going to be issues with the word ruin. Because again, the blight and the ruin porn, the dark tourists that want to come to Detroit. This image of Detroit has been going on for decades now. That is not the reason I titled the book American Ruin, even though it will seem like that to anyone who looks at the cover. Actually, when I was thinking about the title, what really got me on this trip, this research trip for this book, was actually the kids in Detroit. I went to schools, I was speaking to some of the kids who used to be in gangs, who had been shot, who knew people had been killed. And the ruin refers to this generation of children that Detroit is losing to gun violence. And not just Detroit, you know, all across America. And again, not just America, even where I'm from in London, in the UK. The same thing's happening there. Kids are being killed on the streets.
Well, in fact, you even say the crime and poverty that you saw, and I'm going to quote you here. You say, this isn't just Detroit's legacy. This is one that belongs to us all. It is part of the modern history of mankind.
It is. I mean, what's happened in Detroit, you know, its rise and its fall. This isn't just a Detroit problem. This is for everybody. I also say in a book, if you want to know about America, study Detroit. Because what happens here can happen everywhere. And I see elements of what's happening here happening elsewhere. I live in Vancouver now in Canada, and I'm starting to see some things happening there with regards to the disparity in wealth. And again, the gang violence. You see elements of what's happening in Detroit happening elsewhere. So the rise and fall of Detroit isn't just Detroit's history. I think it's part of the world's history.
And when we say rise and fall, and maybe we're cutting to the end, but where do you see Detroit's arc now from when you first came and 15 years ago?
Well, so, you know, when I first came, there was nothing here. You know, there was no downtown. Now there is a great downtown. You know, and it's not just downtown. Eastern Market, Corktown, Mexican Town, all these nice places. But where do I see Detroit going in its rise and fall in its history? When I speak to people, they see it going in the direction of Chicago, where you're going to have this nice downtown area, which builds up in the outer neighborhoods. You're going to get the crime and the gang continuing. And I see that. And certainly when I speak to people in Detroit, in the neighborhoods, that's kind of how they feel. I mean, I was speaking to a lady the other day, and I asked her what she thought about downtown. And she says, I don't go downtown. She goes, I don't go to these shishi $200 restaurants to eat. That's for people who live outside Detroit. If I want to go and eat, I eat in the suburbs or in the neighborhoods. And she was quite angry about what she was seeing happening to Detroit. I mean, I say in the book as well, you know, you can't be upset about what's happened downtown, because anyone who knows Detroit, anyone who cares about Detroit, must be pleased with the development that's happened down there.
But there's a big but.
There's a big but. It's, you know, everything's about balance, and it seems very, very unbalanced at the moment. Downtown's great, of course it is. It looks fantastic. But outside of downtown, there is another Detroit. It's like two cities. And I think a lot of people don't quite, they hear the stories, they watch the news reports. The 13-year-old kid was shot the other day on a basketball court. A 4-year-old kid was shot. His father was shot. They hear these stories, the recent serial killer they had. Mm. But I don't think people really quite grasp just how bad it is, or how desperate it is in these neighborhoods, and how the kids feel, and how the people that have been there for decades feel. The prosperity that's happening downtown isn't reaching them. One lady said to me, she goes, you know, Woodward Avenue downtown is nicely paved, it's beautiful. But you head north on Woodward and you reach a line where the road condition changes. And she said, that's where the money stops. She's absolutely right. That is where the money stops. Now, it's a difficult balancing act for anyone who's trying to rebuild Detroit. I get that. But it just doesn't seem like any of that money is going outside. And when you've got kids who are in schools with no heating, no books, no pens, no teachers sometimes, they're teaching each other, no toilet roll in the toilets. And yet hundreds of millions of dollars of school taxes are being taken from them and will continue to be taken from them until the, you know, 2050. To be given to a sports arena downtown that they won't visit, it just seems unbalanced.
If you've just joined us, I am talking with Michael Matthews, whose book, American Ruin, is a look at Detroit and Detroit Police Department. Michael is a longtime member of the London Metropolitan Police. He's on leave right now. And so the perspective of someone looking from outside eyes who comes from a law enforcement background got me kind of wondering. Let's compare and contrast about ways that police in London and in Detroit face the same issues. Gangs?
Yes.
Definitely. Drugs?
Yes.
Staffing?
Yes. It's not quite as extreme as what Detroit's going through, but yes.
Racial tensions?
Yes.
Poverty?
Absolutely.
All right. Are there other ways? Are there things I've missed that
no,
are,
I mean,
that
all
they
these,
share?
All these things exist, you know, not just Detroit, not just London.
Sure, sure.
Everywhere. But it's more extreme here. So we have gangs, and it's been well publicized recently, a lot of stabbings in London. Guns are very, very rare.
And there's where I wanted to get into the important differences. Here in the U.S., and certainly as you saw as you rode with Detroit police officers, guns are ever present. And yet we hear a whole lot, including our president was tweeting about knife crime. And I've heard that from people who live in London. That's a big concern.
It's something the media's really jumped on at the moment, the amount of knife crime that's happening in London and the kids that are stabbing each other. And Trump tweeted that the mayor of London, Mayor Khan, needed to sort out the problems in London because it's a mess, whatever he said. And I kind of chuckled to myself. I was in Detroit when he said that. And I'm thinking about the problems in Detroit and Chicago and Baltimore. And I'm hearing him talking about London. Yes, crime is getting high in London. The stabbings are getting quite serious. And we are losing children to stabbings and gang violence. But again, it's not to the level. And London's a city of 10 million people, whereas Detroit's, 700,000? Big, big differences there. And we may have 150 murders a year in a city of 10 million people. So yes, we have problems without a doubt. And we do have poverty. But you know, it's not quite the same. There's a professor who did a report. He's actually asked by the Americans to do a report on the state of America when it comes to poverty. And out of 37 countries, the US ranked 35th for poverty and inequality. And you know, you're talking about 40% of children living in poverty. Mm-hmm. Some live in extreme poverty. We're talking millions and millions of people.
It's a story that, as you say, goes way beyond Detroit.
Absolutely. This is not just a Detroit problem.
Back to policing, and I kind of want to press you now on something that you wrote. And you wrote it as you recounted talking with an officer about a shooting that he was involved with when he was off duty. He was at a gas station, and he wound up rescuing a man who was being attacked by two men carrying guns, and bullets flew. And I'm going to quote you here. Whether a shooting is justified or not, it is obviously an awful thing for the family of the deceased to go through, but it is also something that takes a terrible toll on the officers and their families. Despite what some want to believe, no cop actually wants to shoot someone. So I have to point out there are way too many cell phone videos of police officers shooting unarmed people, mainly people of color, sometimes in the back. Sometimes, for example, Philando Castile in Minneapolis, he was shot 7 times, even as he was in a car obeying everything that the officer ordered him to do. How do we explain these videos and jibe it with that statement you made?
No one comes to work, no cop comes to work thinking today I want to shoot somebody. I mean, unless they're completely insane. I've been around this country for many, many years. I've ridden with many police departments. I speak to lots of cops. I've never met a cop that actually wants to shoot anybody. I can't imagine there would be a cop that wants to do that.
What do you think when you see those videos?
And I speak to cops about those videos. Mm-hmm. And they look at them and they say, describe it as being a bad shooting. And a cop in New York said to me, he goes, you can never second guess another officer's fear level. Problem with these video clips is that you're seeing a very short segment of time. You don't know what's happened before that. You don't know what the officer was dealing with or the call they've been taken to or whatever it may be has happened beforehand. You also don't understand the environment they're in. And you don't understand that officer's fear level, as the New York cop said to me. So are there bad shootings? Without a doubt. Do I think the officers want to turn up and just murder someone that day? No, I don't. But there are officers that make decisions, and everyone knows about these split-second decisions cops have to make. And some cops make decisions that leave me wondering. And I've been all around this country, and I've seen good policing, I've seen bad policing. For an example, I was in Mississippi some years ago, and the police officer I was patrolling with in a small Delta town, she hadn't even been to the academy yet. So she had a gun and a car and a uniform, and she's patrolling the town with me, and she hadn't even had a training. So the level of training in this country, it varies massively, depending where you go.
What do you think of what you encountered in Detroit?
Detroit, I find officers here are very, very good. Because they are so busy, they become very experienced very, very quickly. You know, I've been to very quiet places mm-hmm. where the cops are kind of bored. And that concerns me far more than an officer who works in a busy environment where they are just that much more switched on. They're that more aware of what's happening around them. And they see a situation that maybe in another town, the officer may, their fear level will go up. In Detroit, it's just another day on the streets of Detroit. So I find them to be underpaid and understaffed, undervalued and under-resourced. But I find them themselves are very experienced, very knowledgeable, far more experienced than officers I've seen elsewhere.
What do you see from the perspective of someone coming from the UK and really spending these years diving into relations between Detroit police and the people they are policing? How would you characterize those relations?
The first thing I want to say, I'm not a casual visitor here.
No.
I've been coming here for a long time, so
right.
I didn't just turn up saying, I'm going to write a book about Detroit.
No, over 15 years you've done visiting, you've watched things play out. So how would you say things are?
The relationship, for the most part, and this is probably the same everywhere, but let's just talk about Detroit. The relationship, from what I've seen, is generally very good. There's always going to be people that don't like the police for whatever reason. But I find the cops here...
Maybe police who stayed on the job too long. And do you think?
What you're finding now is a lot of young officers, the older officers are going, and we're getting a very young department now, and that's happening everywhere. That's another issue, inexperience that's coming through. And I mean, to give you an example, I was in the 10th precinct the other day with a cop, and we went to a party store. It was a green light party store, so we went in just to pay a visit. It was late at night, it was in a gang area. We'd already been down the street where all the gang was hanging out, and he was talking to them, and I was talking to them, and they were absolutely fine with us. They liked this cop. There's other cops they said they didn't like. But we're in this party store, and one guy walked in, and he wanted to buy some food, I think, for his kids that evening. And he had $3 short. So the cop just went to his wallet and gave the guy $3. Immediately afterwards, another guy, who was one of the gang kids we'd just been speaking to, came in. He wanted a bottle of water because it was very hot. It was a dollar. He didn't have a dollar. The cop paid for that water. And that wasn't done for my benefit. You know, I want to stress that. He didn't just do it because I was there. This is a cop that's known me for a long time. In fact, it's Sergeant Brannock, who's in the book. This is a cop that's known
me for a long time. Yes.
Yeah, you know, he's a very experienced police officer.
Yes.
But, you know, he cares deeply about the people and about the city. And that, I think that comes across in the book, just how much he and other officers actually do care. Because you can't police an environment like this and not care about the people. They take kids to school. They collect the kids and take them for something to eat after school. They really genuinely care. They deal with the criminals, yes. Criminals are criminals. They deal with them. But a lot of these gang guys, they know personally. And I want to say that they're friends with them, but they have a good relationship with them. I see the relationship being quite extraordinary because I've been to other places where cops say to me, you know, they're criminals. That's all they are. They have no time for them. They write them off. But in Detroit, and again, I think it's because of the environment they're in, how busy it is and how much experience these cops get very quickly, they realize, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. You know, this is a tough place to live, a tough place to grow up. And the cops seem to get that. And a lot of them have grown up in Detroit themselves as well. They grew up in these neighborhoods. I was speaking to a guy the other day. His mum lives in the northeast of Detroit, where a lot of this book is set.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most violent areas of the city. And she still lives there. He grew up there. These aren't guys that are coming in from elsewhere. Some do. But a lot of these cops grew up in Detroit. They understand the streets and they understand the people. So they have a real empathy for them.
What do you want readers to get from reading American Ruin?
This book is a kind of behind-the-scenes look at Detroit policing. Lots of books have been written about Detroit, not all of them positive. This isn't an attack on Detroit. This book is really, it's an unprecedented look at the Detroit policing and also gangs and about the city. It's an area of the city people won't know about or won't fully understand. And the cops here have really opened up to me about their lives, the PTSD they suffer, the crime they've dealt with, how it's affected them, and they talk about how they feel about the city. They've really opened up about that. I was told no other writer's been given this access to the Detroit Police Department. It's not just about the police. This is about the city of Detroit. It's about the kids. It's about the gangs as well and the people of Detroit. It's a real behind-the-scenes look at Detroit that hasn't been done before.
How did this whole experience, these years of visiting Detroit, and then you'd go back to work in London, how did that just change your view of policing and also of your London roots?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, the London police are kind of like the original police. So Robert Peel started the police. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous force. It's 30,000 police officers in a city of 10 million people. And here you have Detroit with its, you know, small number of officers. I think they have like 1,500 officers now working in this environment where they're not as well equipped or as well trained or as well paid. But I actually learned an awful lot from coming here, and I continue to learn from the cops and from the people I speak on the streets. And again, it goes back to this relationship they have and this understanding and this empathy. We have empathy, of course. You know, in London, cops do, we do empathize with people. And you can't not when you deal with them all day in, day out, and you see how they live. But in Detroit, you know, I always come away feeling different. It may sound strange, but I come away feeling like I want to be a better cop because of how I see they police here and see how they are. And, you know, Detroit has this image around the world, and Detroit police has an image. You know, it's a tough town. It's a violent town. It's high murder rate. But actually, the cops here are really good. Some people don't want to believe that. They want to believe the cops are violent or they want to shoot people. You know what? You get good cops and you do get bad cops. And you get cops that make wrong decisions sometimes. It doesn't mean they are bad. But the cops in Detroit are some of the best I've ever seen and some of the best I've seen in America, certainly.
The book is American Ruin, written by my guest, Michael Matthews. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.